So there are even two recording devices which reflect the importance of Hannah Kinsler. So Hannah Kinsler, it's a great pleasure to introduce Hannah. She's a biological discipline professor at the faculty. So technically she's not only, I guess, the department, but the entire faculty as well. And so there's a long list of things that I could say about Hannah. I will just pick a few highlights, and then maybe there's something that you would like to add. So Hannah is a senior lecturer at the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at King's College London. She did her PhD in cultural and medical anthropology at McGill University in Canada, and then also worked at the psychosocial research division at McGill University, and then fortunately for us, I was a member of the department already at the time, and Hannah joined us at King's, and she's doing, as you will see, work that really pushes the boundaries of biomedical understandings of mental health. So this is also reflected in the title of her lecture today. So there are a lot of other things that that I think have shaped your take on life and your research, which is very unique methodologically and conceptually. Among many things, so this is something we can discuss afterwards. Among many things, Hannah used to be a cowgirl, and she used to carry guns. So with that, happy note, on behalf of the department, and on behalf of our research group, and I'm not speaking for the faculty, but also thank you on behalf of the university and the faculty. And I'm knowing what a good speaker you are, I'm giving you your gift already in the beginning.
Oh, that's so, thank you, Hannah. So
over
thank
to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the kind introduction and for having me, for coming to the talk. So, yes, from cowgirl to academic, quite a step, but I guess I'm straddling in the boundaries. So, is it okay? I suppose if I stand here, is it okay for you to see him? Well, I'm not that tall. That's true. So, again, thank you very much for the talk. I will partly read, partly talk freely, depending on how things go, how confident I feel in that moment. So, the talk is entitled "The Politics of Mental Health System Reform in Context of Humanitarian Emergencies Towards a Theory of Practice-Based Evidence." So it's on the one hand sort of institutional research, but also I'm trying to make a contribution to theory through this. So humanitarian emergencies as opportunity for mental health. This view is shared by many researchers and interventionists alike. WHO's Building Back Better report, for example, states on its first page, "Emergencies, in spite of their tragic nature and adverse effects on mental health, are also unparalleled opportunities to improve the lives of large numbers of people through mental health reform." Similarly, Patel and colleagues write, "Crisis situations offer the international humanitarian community a unique opportunity to create new services or reorganize and reform pre-existing ones, so that short-term support may be transitioned into sustainable mental health and psychosocial support programs." The science and technology journalist Greg Miller goes as far as to state, "Often it takes a disaster to get mental health on the agenda." And in the same report, Shikhar Saxena, the director of the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse at WHO, is quoted to have said, "Until something terrible happens, politicians don't think about mental health, and therefore our," so the interventionist's, "job is systematically shaming them into thinking about it." So I agree, crisis situations are fertile grounds for mental health system reform, as they can be conveniently piggybacked on emergency interventions. Such emergency interventions are in turn driven by what Calhoun has called the emergency imaginary. Such emergency imaginaries assume notions of suddenness, unpredictability, shock, surprise. They are believed to demand urgent responses rather than political or economic analysis to improve people's lives. Such emergency responses tend to be organized and led by international healthcare providers or international humanitarian actors in collaboration with local experts who largely implement rather than lead the initiatives. So they have inbuilt power differentials here. In the field of mental health, the emergency imaginary is a productive force, so it tends to lead to an influx of resources which make developments possible that were hitherto unthinkable. They allow a shift in perspective in that perceptions of dismantled mental health systems are now perceived as opportunities rather than just as decrepit structures. And they allow for a mobilization of media and public sympathy towards mental health and mental health system reform. So accordingly, emergency contexts are fruitful for decision makers to be able to consider options that can go beyond the status quo. When humanitarians, actors reform mental health systems abroad, they claim that they base this on evidence-based practice, and evidence-based practice, according to them, informs training of local health, mental health providers, the advocacy of the implementation of mental health and psychosocial interventions, the promotion and expansion of community mental health care, and then the downsizing of long-stay psychiatric hospitals. However, what is less well known is what kind of work and activities are actually performed when mental health systems are reformed. What is it that international humanitarian aid workers and local experts do on the ground? We know very little about this. What are the actual activities they perform in order to enable and sustain system reform? And I believe failing to discuss mental health system reform as practice and work is a crucial omission. And what I want to do in order to contribute to this field is to develop something that I call practice-based evidence. This allows me, what I like about this idea, and it's very much inspired from also conversations that I had with Barbara, is that I can distance myself from critics who try to debunk concepts like evidence-based medicine, evidence-based policy, evidence-based practice, because I do believe that at the end of the day, evidence is important when it comes to healthcare and health system development. But where I do see a flaw is that thinking about knowledge as something that is primary and practice something that is sort of follows suit in that process. So I want to turn it the other way around. So I believe that the opposite is true. And in order to think about this through examples, through more concrete cases, I choose two places where I've done long-term ethnographic research, which is Kosovo, where I'm working since 2004, and then the West Bank of the occupied Palestinian territory, where I work since 2012. To see how practice-based evidence rather than evidence-based practice shape mental health system reform processes. And at the end, I want to conclude with some theoretical thoughts and also some questions that this kind of research might raise. You know? So, but before, I want us to shift our lens from evidence-based practice to practice-based evidence, I want to look at what I call the dominant view about mental health system reform in war and post-war context. So this photograph is the psychiatric hospital in Pristina in Kosovo. You can see there's quite a bit of construction going on, that's why I like the photo. So thinking about mental health system reform and how it is usually reported about is that in the aftermath, after immediate crises are over, emergency mental health interventions generally serve as a basis for reform. And these kind of emergency mental health interventions can be something like psychological first aid, certain counseling approaches, structural intervention. They are then used to as a basis to extend mental health and psychosocial programs much more widely on a system level. The focus is hereby put on enhancement of government-driven policies, improving human resources and training, increasing programming and services, performing research and program monitoring, and sustaining finances. Thereby, it is aimed to transition mental health systems in these places from highly institutionalized approaches to community-based ones. So it is often that mental health is provided in psychiatric hospitals where people are locked away. This is considered inappropriate internationally, so these kind of crisis situations serve as an opportunity to basically open the doors of these asylums and then to provide mental health care in community centers and within the community so people don't get unnecessarily locked up. So this is the idea behind this. To then aid in this process, and this is where the evidence base comes in, WHO, for instance, has created a mental health policy service guidance package, which contains various training and advocacy modules that you can follow, and if you follow them, then apparently you're able to reform mental health systems effectively. The underlying assumption is that you should bring together global research evidence with context-specific knowledge in order to reform appropriately. And thus, a linear approach is assumed, where you come with knowledge which you translate into guidelines. The guidelines are then adapted to the local context, which are then implemented. They're evaluated, further improved as they're implemented. But what you can see here from this scheme, so knowledge is at the beginning, context somewhere in the middle, and then the practice happens sort of towards the end of this process, as it is imagined in the reports. Such approaches are, of course, not new and not particular to post-war situations. They also inform mental health system development in development contexts, so in global mental health scenarios. What is special about post-war situations is that the emergency imaginary sort of allows a fast-tracking of these developments along these lines, because there's a lot of urgency behind this. Money gets freed, doors are on the ground, things get done very quickly, in a sense, which is in other development situations not necessarily the case. Examples where such reforms were attempted or done are listed in WHO's Building Back Better report, to include Afghanistan, Burundi, Indonesia, Iraq, Jordan, Kosovo, Palestine, Somalia, Sri Lanka, and East Timor. But what remains quite unclear from the report is what reforming mental health systems in these settings actually meant. So we hear a lot about what was accomplished, but not exactly how it was accomplished. And I would also question some of these accomplishments in the glossy report journals. So this is sort of the dominant view that we're used to when we think about mental health system reform or system reforms in general. What I would like to do now is to focus, to shift the gaze to practice, where practice comes first and engenders context and knowledge. And I actually really want to thank Barbara, who suggested the term in the first place, so it is Barbara's term in one of our meetings, and also for her suggestion to have a look at the work by the philosopher Cook and policy scholar Wagenaar and their research on practice and practice-based evidence. And in their joint work, the authors argue that it is not primary knowledge and context that shape practice, but rather that knowledge and context are artifacts that emerge through practice. Yeah? And it is and this kind of knowledge and context emerges particularly as people are working in, living in situations of uncertainty, complexity, and often lack of limits of predictability. So according to this view, practice is seen as primary and distinct and gives shape to knowledge and context. So the model looks it's flipped basically on its head, where knowledge comes last and practice comes first. Which does not mean that knowledge is not important. It's just a different way of thinking. And what I want to argue, what I want to argue is that mental health system reforms in context of both crisis and development are less based on systematized knowledge or evidence than born out of situations where people don't know, or at least don't completely know, what decisions to take, where the problems to be tackled are contested, and where the course of action is rather unclear. To explore such practice systematically, I'm guided by Cook and Wagener's three key concepts that undergird practice, which they call actionable understanding, ongoing business, and the eternally unfolding present. And I will go into these very briefly and also discuss how these concepts allow me to think about certain questions differently, I suppose, than before. So let me start with actionable understanding. This concept is based on the premise that as people undertake their ordinary task, they engage in a flow of activities. And within this flow, they might get confronted with situations that obstruct it. And situations that then revolve or resolve out of these routine tasks require action through actionable understanding. That is, practices are performed within which new knowledge can be created. So this knowledge actually gets created through practice, because that's what people do, they engage in their tasks. It might get disrupted, they shift gear, they have to do something different. As they do something different, they also learn new things in this process. Knowledge which they can then later share. For me, this raises interesting questions for mental health system reforms in crisis situations. So one of them is, what forms of practice emerge within humanitarian settings that might generate new knowledge that could facilitate mental health system reform? Another one is, what kind of knowledge is considered useful and by who? And then, what other tools besides knowledge are utilized by the actors involved to facilitate their practice, and how do they thereby change the context within which they work? Yeah, these are some questions that the concept of actionable understanding inspired me to think about. This leads me to the second concept by the authors, the ongoing business. So, and here the authors write that much of our everyday life, but also our work, is mostly habitual, consisting of ongoing business, which doesn't require much overthinking. I think otherwise we would get nothing done. So we just, and as people go about their business as usual, they share experiences and activities collectively, and thereby shape knowledge and context. While it might appear contradictory to think of war, situations of war and conflict as ongoing business, it has to be recognized that a lot of the humanitarian intervention is, at least for the most part, enacted quite routinely. Yeah? So questions that emerge for me here are, what are the routine actions and understandings, predictable behaviors of stakeholders, and expectations of humanitarian practice? So what do we expect to be there that are sometimes not quite conscious about this? What happens when ongoing business gets disrupted? And what forms of practice does this engender? What kind of knowledge gets deployed and or generated? And then finally, the eternally unfolding presence. quite a poetic term, which I like, draws our attention to the fact that negotiations, reform activities, and evaluations take place in the here and now. It is not that we fall back on sort of a stored repertoire of standardized knowledge, like in a warehouse, that we can then refer to and bring to the situation at hand, and based on this knowledge then act. It is that as people act, and in this process, they create but also apply knowledge. It's not that knowledge gets never applied, but it is applied as people are acting and going about their business. In the context of mental health system reform, this does of course not mean that humanitarian aid providers arrive at the scene without knowledge. This would be naive to think. But what I would like to argue is that they set to work and thereby put pre-existing knowledge to use, generate new insights, and develop pathways through which they change the context that they face. So it is about getting to work and in this process apply knowledge but also generate new knowledge. So from this perspective, the idea of evidence-based practice is completely overrated, according to my opinion. So here, how does practice contribute to knowledge and context in mental health system reform processes following emergencies? What new insights can be gained and made useful for other development contexts? These are some of the questions that this concept engendered. So to explore these questions related to actionable understanding, ongoing business, and the eternally unfolding present further, I want to apply them to two case studies. The first one is Kosovo, the second one is the West Bank in Palestine. So the first case study I entitled Experimenting with Community-Based Mental Health Care in Kosovo. So the Kosovo War became infamously known in 1998-1999 as it led to a huge international response, humanitarian response at the time. Serbian forces had exerted extreme violence against the Albanian population, including large-scale killings and mass displacement. In fact, at the time, 90% of the population was internally or externally displaced. In response to this unfolding humanitarian catastrophe, aid providers, including health professionals, descended into the refugee camps, which started to spring up around in the countries that surrounded Kosovo, in order to provide protection, aid, and healthcare to the population. What they expected when they came was that they would be dealing with injury, malnourishment, and possibly certain infectious disease outbreaks. So when they packed their aid kits, that's how it usually works, they brought dressing materials for fixing broken bones, cuts and burns, supplements to improve diets, and medication to curtail potential disease outbreaks. Yet standard operation procedures and routine actions, understanding these tools, was actually not what was needed. Instead, aid workers were taken by surprise when they realized that the refugees came to seek help for for psychological problems due to the extreme violence that they had either experienced or witnessed at the time. Many of the interventionists felt completely overwhelmed by this because nobody had ever received training in mental health. This is not what was provided in crisis situation. That was considered a luxury. Yeah. So they had nothing to go on. There was no blueprint. So nevertheless, and despite their lack of knowledge and expertise, they started to develop ad hoc psychiatric intervention strategies geared towards healing the inner wounds of war, the traumas of war. And so a situation was thus encountered which demanded acting by shifting gears and not to press on as one would have done in other circumstances. So Instead, actionable understanding was required to generate new forms of practice, and in this process acquire new forms and new useful knowledges. So what happened was that these aid providers, they didn't have the capacity to provide all this mental health care and psychosocial support and counseling by themselves, but they literally drove through the camps with loudspeakers, asking for refugees to come forward who could possibly provide counseling services or who could be easily trained. These could be doctors. They were not really psychologists, but social workers, sociology students. They really like to employ sociology students for some reason. And then they trained them in diagnostic manuals, scales, treatment protocols, and then integrated them into the line of humanitarian assistance work, mostly as assistants. So here you can see the very typical power relations. And having said that, a bit in a funny way, that they like to hire the sociologists, I actually met some of these people who were young people, students at the time. And they changed their path, so now they're psychologists or psychiatrists, because that really made an impression on them. So there were real changes and career shifts thanks to these developments. Then, once the war was over and the refugees were returning back into Kosovo, the humanitarian aid organizations followed the refugee population back into the country. So they literally joined the refugee tracks and in their trucks and cars moved with them into Kosovo. So what then happened was that they implemented a variety of training and intervention strategies and programs, and people, experts from all over the world came into the country to lecture, organize workshops, administer exams, provide certificates. On a system level, WHO spearheaded the establishment of a government mental health unit and conducted a rapid assessment of the mental health situation and of the system itself and the needs of the population. This was then followed by the formulation of a mental health strategic plan. Community-based mental health centers were built in all regions of the country, and training of mental and primary health care providers got underway. And this was at the time the largest operation of WHO worldwide ever in their history. Because usually WHO is not a body that intervenes. It channels money into projects. It's not really their own money. It, of course, comes from the member states. But in this case, they actually intervene themselves. It's an exception, and the West Bank is another such exception in WHO's working. What was less clear at the time was how to actually then implement these reform processes on the ground, because there were no blueprints, there were no illustrative case studies at the time. Mental health had not been provided in war and post-war situations very much, so this was very much an experimental character. And interventionists locally and internationally, they experimented with various forms of self-help groups for families, for instance, with a concept where self-help groups for families with mental health problems. These were interventions that had been adapted from HIV prevention initiatives in the US, so US interventionists had experience with these kind of interventions. Well, they thought, let's try this out amongst these Kosovars who have family members with mental health problems, and apparently that, according to them, that worked quite well. Other initiatives included the creation of psychoeducational multi-family group programs that was provided within the community mental health centers to improve access to treatment, combat stigma, and raise awareness amongst the population. And what was, in fact, interesting about this was that These kind of initiatives, no matter how experimental they were, they in fact did lead to some policy development on the level of the Kosovar Ministry of Health, which are now and where they now require such multi-family groups in each of their community mental health centers in the village, as well as home visits. Yet, as the emergency situation calmed down in Kosovo, of course, the funding and the funders and the experts also retracted. Yeah? So emergency is productive, and when it stops being an emergency, it is less productive. So the director of a community mental health center told me, for example, that since the internationals left to Afghanistan, so 9/11, his center was hardly able to come up with the necessary funds to pay its employees and finance the treatments and programs offered for the patients. There continues to be a huge shortage of personnel, so you have 1.9 psychiatrists, 0.3 psychologists, 8.8 psychiatric nurses, and 0.5 social workers. So, and here you have some comparative numbers. Apparently, Germany really likes their social workers, which is a bit of an outlier, I suppose. Moreover, the healthcare budget is very little, so only 2% of an already underfunded healthcare budget is spent on mental health, which makes both treatment and follow-up practice difficult. And this was then the case and continues to be problematic today. So while one could, and I did so for the longest time, just really write scathing critiques about international humanitarian intervention that comes in with the promise of sustainability, and then you end up with a situation like this, I do start to realize that the reforms and the reform activities did lead to changes. They improved access to mental health care. There was no community mental health care. The situation in the asylum was terrible. The provision of services was a challenge, but nevertheless, services started to be provided, and despite the finance and training and coordination difficulties that, of course, existed. So this, I think, should also be recognized in these contexts, and that local practitioners themselves do an enormous amount of work, working under really, really precarious and difficult conditions to provide healthcare to their patients. But this then brings me to my second case study, which is lessons learned, or learning by doing, in Palestine's mental health system reform. So as the international community was scaling down the interventions in Kosovo, its headquarters in Geneva, so WHO's headquarters in Geneva, received an inquiry, a phone call, from the Palestinian Ministry of Health asking for a situational analysis of the mental health of the population and the functioning of the mental health system. The reason for reaching out was that human rights organizations and health providers had reported an alarming increase of distress and trauma-related mental health problems connected to the ongoing Second Intifada, so the Palestinian uprising. WHO responded by sending Benedetto Saraceno, the then director of the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse of the WHO, to lead a situational analysis. And he applied the WHO AIMS tool, which is the World Health Organization assessment instrument for mental health systems. And the emerging data showed particular needs, but especially also system gaps, where it became very clear that the mental health system was not up to speed to actually deal with not only the emerging mental health problems, but also the pre-existing ones in an appropriate way. So based on these findings, recommendations were formulated and an operational plan was made, which was then signed by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the World Health Organization, and the French and Italian development organizations. And the aim was explicitly stated, and I quote from their report, developing, reorganizing, improving, and expanding current mental health services according to a community-based mental health approach. Let's see where I am here. So this included limited funding from the European Union for the building of community mental health centers, the formulation of a mental health policy, an anti-stigma campaign, and the formation of family associations. So while such initiatives had appeared quite experimental immediately after the Kosovo War, they achieved the character of ongoing business in conflict-affected Palestine. Here we had blueprints. There were case studies now available from different parts of the world. However, this is not to say that reform practices in Palestine were solely sort of ongoing business. People had to continue to think on their feet in a context that was very much shaped by large-scale politics rather than evidence-based guidelines that determined where health system or any system reform could go. And an example of this is, for instance, in 2006, when the reform processes came to a grinding halt as Palestinians in the West Bank democratically elected Hamas into government, as Hamas was considered to be a terrorist organization by the donor countries, they refused to provide further funding into any government-run businesses. So funding was stopped. I was told, for instance, when the elections happened, we were supposed to receive the projects or the funding from the EU, but they had frozen the funds, so we were affected, and this delayed the reform to start. Consequently, the building of the community mental health centers was suspended, and the mental health policy remained unfinished, making it completely impossible for mental health providers to provide mental health care in the community. Most of them had no salaries and worked for a long time for free, but then also, of course, you run out of goodwill as well. The situation then changed again in 2007 when the Palestinians besought themselves and Mahmoud Abbas was elected to form an emergency government in the West Bank. And as a result of this political shift, funding then was made available again by the EU to underwrite the implementation of the mental health policy. So, yeah, here you see the kind of patchy effort of reform and funding dependency. So at first sight, it might appear that international actors, as well as local actors, simply reacted to international or national political contexts, which would be the opposite to what Cook and Wagner's practice theory would suggest. A closer look reveals, however, that local and international mental health professionals acted in what the authors would call the eternally unfolding present. In fact, people on the ground reacted quite innovatively, in that very unlike in the context of Kosovo, where the mental health system was very much geared towards government-run initiatives, people in Palestine themselves didn't quite trust the sustainable ability of their own government. They had seen it fall often enough. So instead, they invested or also trust the NGO sector much more. And so NGOs mostly filled in the blank. The Ministry of Health does not provide and continues to not provide very good services. In fact, sometimes they are abysmal. And so quite good mental health care is provided by NGOs. They provide also training, they raise awareness, and through and over time, they developed great expertise in therapeutic treatment strategies. They increased partnerships between organizations. For some time it looked a bit like the Wild West, so everybody thought they could intervene, but they made sure that there is a bit of a structure now in place. And better integration of mental health into primary health care was something that they advocated for and work on. Nevertheless, lots of challenges remain. First of all mental health providers I've talked to lament or criticize the unstable project-like character of these reform processes. And you could see this here, where it just goes from one funding cycle to the next, and you can never know whether more funding will be poured into the system. So the latest phase of funding was in 2015, and each time different strings are attached to these funding circles. And this makes sustainability, of course, extremely difficult to achieve, and also long-term, the establishment of long-term social relations is difficult to achieve between practitioners and patients, as projects shift constantly. And so similar to the situation in Kosovo, it appears to require the heightened state of emergency for the freeing up of funds in order to build systems. But building a system per se is not considered urgent enough to warrant the distribution of resources on a regular basis. So, also in this case here, the Palestinian Ministry of Mental Health System always gets a boost of money when there is again a crisis. So it's kind of a perverse situation where you get almost, where you benefit from crisis situation for your own organizations, because otherwise it's very hard to justify that you need that money for development. So, what do these case studies tell us? Here I'm trying to think about practice-based evidence. Based on the two case studies, I'm calling to rethink the notion of evidence-based practice. And to unravel this a bit further, I want to go back to the beginning of my talk, where I talked about crisis situations as opportunities. And opportunity in such arguments is directly linked to action and not primarily to reflection and analysis. This is in line with the concept of opportunity itself, which, according to the Oxford Dictionary, refers to an occasion or situation that makes it possible to do something. And the possibility of doing something in the aftermath of political violence is, as I was able to show, very much shaped by the notion of the emergency imaginary, which suggests that immediate action is required to improve people's lives in the shortest possible time. And so resulting from this, you have a heightened industriousness amongst the various actors in Kosovo and Palestine. It became apparent that international and national actors speedily freed material resources, changed the attitudes of policymakers to embrace the possibility for reforming systems, and mobilized media attention to also shape public sentiment on the ground. And in an extremely short period of time, researchers and interventionists collected, analyzed, and reported data reflecting the mental health situations on the ground, drew up action plans, signed memoranda of understanding, built entirely new infrastructures, and performed novel forms of community-based mental health care. The practice involved in these developments were undertaken in extremely complex and uncertain and unpredictable contexts. But context here is not to be understood as sort of a stable, rigid container that shapes or constrains action. It is, and I quote Wagner here, a dynamically integrated system of changing relations and therefore also a productive tool. So the negotiation in turn involves habits and routine actions. So humanitarian situations, they are performed quite routinely. People come now with their mental health kits and their first aid kits for mental health, and they at least think they know exactly what to do. It involves thinking on one's feet, improvising, to arrive at something that reflects actionable understanding, and it involves being in the present, whereby past experiences are brought together with future aspirations. So in order for the situation, however, not to slip into chaos as people are busy doing things, rather than possibly analyzing, it is not enough to say, well, maybe it would work better if you knew the context better. This is something that a lot of also anthropologists claim, that people should just really do their homework, learn about the situation on the ground, and then start implementing. But it is much more dynamic, where social relations have to be built between actors and the environment. But I think what became clear was that not only the international actors, but also the national experts were far from knowing the situations they were dealing with. They were often unprepared for what they were confronted with and did not initially know what decisions to take. This is not to say that guidelines in these cases were completely useful or scientific evidence had no place. This is, of course, not the case. It's not that they were irrelevant. They were just not blueprints for action. Thus, for guidelines or evidence to be useful, they had to enter into a dynamic relationship with practice, knowledge, and context. And unlike the glossy reports by organizations, such an interaction does not necessarily lead to success. Of course, we still have the problem with the laboratory character of system reform, the shattered dreams of sustainability, and the unequal power relations in the field. So what I think is fruitful, at least for me, with this shift of knowledge, and I'm coming to an end here, is the kind of questions that it allows me to ask that are the different, maybe, than other institutional research that is carried out, and questions that I want to explore further. So what do these practices do to intended beneficiaries and to local cultures more broadly? What is the effect of all this mental health delivery reform on people's lives? How do local professionals experience the changes in professional practice that reform efforts produce? But then also, how do these reforms also respond and become intermeshed with the much more bigger structural problems in people's lives, such as poverty, corruption, ethnic conflict, etc.? So attempting to understand the various ways in which mental health systems are reformed and treatment delivered requires a move, in my opinion, a move away from evidence-based practice to a recognition of the contribution of practice-based evidence to develop meaningful and lasting change based on the unfolding and dynamic realities on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.